manhood, there is a generation who is not yet spoiled, not yet degutted, not yet deboled, not yet emasculated, who, when they come into the light of his truth, will rise up and redeem him and us and all the rest of the world. That is the meaning of Malcolm X.
That was Ossie Davis remembering Malcolm X. It's the 50th anniversary of his assassination. He was killed February 21st, 1965. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
KBOO Community Radio and Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights are proud to sponsor a panel discussion called Occupation, Environmental Destruction, and the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement. A panel discussion on international resistance this Tuesday, February 24th at the PSU Smith Center Ballroom. This panel will feature the Portland appearance of Palestinian intellectual and activist Omar Barghouti, as well as Kanahus Manuel, mother of four and First Nations anti-mining activist from British Columbia, Cecily Saraski, communications director of Jewish Voice for Peace, and Dr. Michael Yellowbird, professor of sociology and anthropology and director of Indigenous Peoples Studies at North Dakota State University. That's Occupation, Environmental Destruction, and the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, a panel discussion on international resistance, February 24th at PSU's Smith Center Ballroom, 1825 Southwest Broadway in Portland. More information on the KBOO webpage on the right side under Community Events.
As citizens of a so-called democratic society, we need to have information that ranges from A to Z, not what we have, which is A to B.
KBOO is proud to present An Evening with David Barsamian, Wednesday, March 4th, 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. All proceeds will benefit KBOO Community Radio. One of America's most tireless and wide-ranging investigative journalists, David Barsamian is the host of Alternative Radio. Again, that's An Evening with David Barsamian, Wednesday, March 4th at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 5:01, and you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Coming up next is the evening news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, protesters in Washington shut down a bridge to challenge a recent police shooting of a Latino man in Pasco.
Oregon residents file lawsuits against six local stores for profiling shoppers based on race.
An Illinois lawsuit is challenging the classification of animal rights activists as terrorists.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, February 23rd, 2015. I'm Joanna Peterson.
And I'm Rosalind Scott. The operator for the Port of Portland's container terminal said that longshore workers participated in an illegal work slowdown yesterday. This came 2 days after the Longshoremen's Union and the Maritime Association reached a coastwide agreement that was expected to restore productivity. The pact included a new conflict resolution system, which was supposed to solve disputes like these in the future. But on Sunday, Portland's terminal operators said that the Longshoremen's Union did not provide labor service to the Hanjin Copenhagen, which is the port's largest carrier, and has been docked at the terminal for nearly 3 weeks. The operators call this an illegal work stoppage. Aside from Portland, the other West Coast ports have resumed productivity, but all 29 ports face a backlog of goods, with some ships waiting to unload offshore. In addition to the backlog, Port of Portland officials will face the difficulty of replacing Hanjin.
The Portland City Council will meet Wednesday to discuss how it will participate in the Joint Terrorism Task Force. This hearing is scheduled after the council voted last Thursday to rejoin the Interagency Task Force after a 10-year hiatus. The city will assign two Portland police officers to work full-time on the task force. Council members are set to vote this Wednesday on signing a memorandum of understanding with the FBI. For more, I spoke with Dan Handelman of Portland Cop Watch. Portland has been kind of an outlier nationally because it's, you know, one of the only big cities that hasn't had officers participate full time. So what's going on with that?
So essentially from 2005 to 2011, we were pulled out of the Joint Terrorism Task Force, even though there was sort of with the possibility that the officers who'd been trained to participate, they didn't really do so. And then in late 2010, we had the Pioneer Square Holiday Tree incident, which was an FBI sting, as KB listeners probably know, on Muhammad, a young Somali man. And they made a big deal out of if only the Portland Police had worked with the Joint Terrorism Task Force. And I don't know the end of that sentence, because in my opinion, at the end of that sentence is, then maybe the FBI wouldn't have paid for his apartment, built a fake explosive device, and set him up to be put in jail for 30 years. I don't know if that's what we want our Portland Police doing, but that's what the FBI does. So, of course, though, the city said, well, maybe we should reconsider this. And in early 2011, they said, well, we're going to participate on a case-by-case basis, and we'll do an annual report to the public so there's some transparency about what's going on. Those annual reports started coming out, and each year they were almost an exact photocopy of the year before, and they basically said nothing. So the mayor at last year's hearing said, this is obviously not working for anybody. I want to rethink this.
So I know both commissioners, Amanda Fritz and Steve Novick, voted against joining. What was their reasoning?
My understanding is that Commissioner Fritz said that she thinks that there's other ways for us to build trust with the communities that may be able to help with such investigations, and joining forces with the FBI is not going to build that trust. And I think Commissioner Novick kind of echoed that sentiment because he had seen a letter that went out from 11 Muslim organizations who say that they represent the majority of Muslims in the Portland area that said, please don't join the terrorism task force. You know, they said that we're willing to work with the FBI in the appropriate times. We're willing to work with the police in the appropriate times. But when you put those two together, you're going to lose the trust of this community.
Portland Cop Watch has kind of called on the city to reverse its course, and if it doesn't reverse, to amend its contract with the FBI. You know, if it doesn't reverse, what should the city make sure to require in its dealings?
Right. Well, some of the problems are there's no sunset date. So every year we used to come in and have a hearing about whether or not we should participate in the terrorism task force, and this would just be a contract with no end date on it. So we're asking them to have at least an annual sunset clause in there so that we can revisit this and see how things are going. And we also feel that there should be, you know, even though these reports we were getting were very threadbare, then what we should do is at those hearings, we should say there were X number of investigations, and then there are three levels of FBI investigations. And the first level, which is called an assessment, would violate that Oregon state law that prohibits investigating people for their political, religious, or social affiliations. And if we find out that our Portland officers are doing those, then we should be pulling out. So we want to have a list of how many times they've done assessments, preliminary investigations, and full investigations.
So finally, all this is happening at an interesting time because, as you probably know, an Oregon resident, Riz Khan, just pleaded guilty to terrorism charges for supporting a 2009 suicide attack in Pakistan. This just really seems to coincide with Portland's choice to participate in the Joint Terrorism Task Force. So do you see a connection there?
Well, I heard that case actually was not brought up by anybody at the city council vote last Wednesday or last Thursday. I think that it's good because it actually is not. I mean, the theory of the investigations that the Portland Police Bureau would be doing wouldn't necessarily find something like that case. So even if you believe what Mr. Khan pleaded guilty to, which, you know, I don't believe anything that has to do with the FBI, since they do the stings like they did with Muhammad have happened in almost every city in the United States at this point. And at least 50% of the terrorism prosecutions since 9/11 have been involving FBI informants and stings. So I have no idea how much to believe any of that story. But even if you believe it all the way to its fullest extent, it's not necessarily something that would have involved the Portland Police to investigate that. So I don't think anybody's using that as an example of why we need to be part of it. Certainly, we have counterexamples of As I said, you know, I think many people in the community believe what happened to Muhammad was unjust. And Brandon Mayfield, who testified on February 5th at council about the JTTF, was wrongfully investigated and imprisoned for being part of a Spanish train bombing plot when the FBI misidentified his thumbprint. And again, we don't want Portland police participating in that kind of nonsense. We really want, we need to have our Portland police doing local stuff that isn't putting innocent people in jail because the FBI has made a mistake or set them up.
That was Dan Handelman with Portland Cop Watch. We've been discussing Portland's choice to participate in the Joint Terrorism Task Force. For KBOO News, I'm Joanna Peterson.
Six businesses in Portland are being sued by African-American customers who were falsely accused of shoplifting. Shakoya Burns is a 32-year-old medical assistant at Providence Portland Medical Center. She has filed a $230,000 lawsuit against Ross Dress for Less and the manager in Southeast Portland after she was asked to leave the store because the manager said she was a known thief. Burns said that she was profiled for her race and has never stolen anything in her life. Five similar lawsuits have been filed by the law firm of Kafuri and McDougall against Walgreens, Walmart, Best Buy, Lloyd Center, and Hollister Company. The lawsuits allege discrimination, false arrest, and slander based on race. Attorney Greg Kafuri states that statistics show that African Americans are disproportionately subject to traffic stops, school suspensions, and prison sentences. Kafuri said that shopping while black is simply another reflection of the depth of systemic discrimination in the U.S. and here in Oregon.
On Saturday, protesters in Pasco, Washington, shut down a bridge over the Columbia River. The protests came in response to the killing of Antonio Zambrano Montes, a Mexican orchard worker, by police 2 weeks ago. Zambrano Montes, who is armed only with a small rock, was the fourth person killed by Pasco police in 6 months. They were responding to a call that he was throwing rocks at vehicles in a supermarket parking lot. Cell phone video footage shows Zambrano Montes with his hands up, attempting to surrender to police when he was shot by multiple live rounds and killed. While the town of Pasco is more than half Latino, its leadership remains largely white. Zambrano Montes' family is suing the city for $25 million. Mexican officials have demanded that his body be returned to his home in Michoacán, Mexico. A local Latino advocacy organization has called for a Department of Justice investigation of the killing.
Two of the items considered by the House Committee on Education at the Oregon State Legislature today were a bill to allow computer coding languages to fill language requirements and a bill creating a task force to look at class sizes. HB 2766 provides that language-based computer coding may satisfy any world language requirements in public schools and second language requirements in community colleges and post-secondary institutions of education. Here's a bit of the testimony from that bill.
We as faculty, and like I said, not only the faculty in the humanities, but also the faculty in the sciences, believe that world languages is not fulfilled by computer coding. Now, we all agree that computer coding is essential in this day and age, but we believe that the House Bill 2766 and the world languages requirement should not be fulfilled by computer coding because it teaches none of the skills that we think a student in this day and age needs to be not only proficient but also successful in our international world. Thank you.
Keep in mind, thank you. Representative Hack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my daughter takes sign language as her requirement for the world language. What in your, tell me how you feel about sign language versus the computer coding, because sign language, well, tell me what you think.
Yes, Madam Chair, and Thank you. This is an excellent question. American Sign Language, I believe, is also in one of the previous bills, was added as, I don't want to say as a special case, but as something that we recognized is a language that we need to be taught so we can communicate with members of our communities. This is not different from other languages. Farm workers who speak Spanish, for example. I think American Sign Language teaches all of the skills that other languages do too. There's one exception, and this is that the oral component is replaced by the hand gestures, the hand motions, and the lip movements. Even as an admission requirement, like I said, we all agree that this is not a world language. So we believe that our students are deficient in foreign languages or world languages to begin with. So it would be only beneficial to them and for the future careers, even in computer sciences, to take up a world language. And so this bill is something that we oppose in this stage, and also as, you know, were it to be rewritten as to include computer coding as an admission requirement.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I apologize, I had another appointment at the beginning of this hearing, so I might have missed this, but I'm actually getting a little more confused. So my statement is truly just a concern that I have that we're clear with. And having a high school senior myself who's been on a track for college and talks about what he needs to take to get into college, to be accepted at college, I want to make sure that we would be ultra clear, depending on how these amendments would flesh out, that we don't have a high schooler thinking, this is a language, it's going to get me into college, apply for college, and the answer is no.
Right.
So I'm just very concerned that that would be well communicated and be very, very clear. I don't even know if we're to the point yet to solidify that, but that's a huge concern that I would have.
Also considered in the House Education Committee today was House Bill 2928, which establishes a task force on class sizes to determine appropriate class sizes of students, identify methods to reduce class sizes, and determine costs for methods to reduce class sizes. Here's some of the testimony heard at the committee hearing in Salem today.
Oregon's dramatically overcrowded classrooms, as you've heard, are known to us because parents and teachers report them anecdotally. They're concerned about students in grade schools who are overwhelmed and act out. They are concerned that providing individual attention has become impossible. They're concerned that grading and commenting on English papers, as our chair has said, is a thing of the past. And they're worried about the students too intimidated by the huge class sizes. And I got this from a radio news report recently, that they were too intimidated by a huge biology class when they didn't understand something to raise their hand and ask. So they're worried about student safety as well. There are a number of issues around class size that really do impede and impair students as they travel throughout the grades from kindergarten all the way through their senior year in high school.
Representative Bruno, there's always one.
You know that you have no stronger supporter than I am for what you're doing. I'll remind you that I was a classroom teacher at David Douglas while my wife was on the school board there. So I was seeing the class sizes increase every year, and my wife would come home, was a very strong woman, as you know, and sobbing because she would have to cut the budget year after year. So knowing that, we already know how important this is, and we have a quality education model that says that the legislature is supposed to fund us up to a much more appropriate level than what we have now. And I want to say this without sounding snarky, because I'm not, I'm really supportive. What is the point? What would this tell us that we don't know?
I appreciate Representative Reardon, I appreciate the actual sentiment of your question. And I thought long and hard before I put this in front of you for that very reason. And the reason is because the public says it's not being addressed. The public, when I walked for the last 5 to 7 months, door to door, there wasn't one single topic that was more apparent as the number one topic on the door on class size? Why aren't you dealing with class size? And even if it's only perception, I think it's extremely important that they see that there is a task force in 2015 and 16 that actually is looking at the new information, the new data, the new statistics that really indicate why class size is important or not, how it relates to technology or not. What are some of the best practices that are showing that a particular age group and a particular size of class needs to happen if you want the best results?
Both of the bills remain in committee for the time being, but may move forward to the full Oregon House for consideration during this session of the state legislature.
A trial continued today in the Multnomah County lawsuit against the companies that installed flawed decking on the Morrison Bridge. The decking was installed in March 2012 and was guaranteed to last 75 to 100 years. But 3 years later, it's already cracking and screws are coming undone. The issue worsened on Friday when officials closed a second lane on the bridge after discovering more problems with the decking. Millions of dollars are on the line as officials try to determine the cost of bridge repairs. Multnomah County seeks more than $6 million in damages from the companies that installed the decking. However, the county is not waiting to settle the lawsuit before repairing the decking. The trial is expected to continue through Friday.
According to the federal government, trains carrying oil and ethanol will derail approximately 10 times per year for the next two decades. This projection comes from previously unreported analysis completed last July by the Department of Transportation. Last week's oil train derailments in Ontario, Canada, and West Virginia increases the urgency for new regulations for tanker cars, such as stronger cars and better braking systems. Both derailment fires occurred with the new style tanker cars. The Canadian derailment was traveling at a speed slower than the newly suggested speed of 40 miles per hour. The 107 cars that burned in West Virginia were carrying 3 million gallons of North Dakota crude. The tankers involved in this latest fire were the new improved tankers, prompting officials to question the need for even stronger cars and regulations. This would require the phasing out of tens of thousands of older tanker cars, although these safety improvements have been objected to by the industry. The trains carrying the oil and ethanol travel through communities with an average population density of 283 people per square kilometer, according to a federal analysis. That means about 16 million Americans live within a half kilometer of one of the lines running across the United States. The transportation groups estimate it would take more than a decade to upgrade all 50,000-plus tanker cars. Oil shipments by rail jumped from 9,500 carloads in 2008 to more than 435,000 in 2013, driven by a boom in the Bakken oil patch of North Dakota and Montana, where pipeline limitations force 70% of the crude to move by rail, according to American fuel and petrochemical manufacturers. Railroads are required by federal order to tell state emergency officials where trains carrying Bakken crude are traveling. In July 2013, an oil train explosion killed 47 people and leveled much of downtown Lac-Mégantic, Quebec. CSX, the company involved in the West Virginia derailment, and other railroads call this information proprietary and refuse to tell local municipalities when they were carrying the Bakken crude. However, more than 20 states rejected the industry's argument, informing the public as well as first responders about the crude moving through their communities. West Virginia, however, is one of those keeping it secret. State officials responded to an AP Freedom of Information request by releasing documents redacted to remove nearly every detail.
Carbon dioxide emissions are affecting more than the air we breathe in the Northwest. They are hurting the shellfish and the oceans. A new report by the Ocean Conservancy ranks the Oregon and Washington coasts as areas that will be dramatically affected by the acidification of the ocean's waters and the runoff from farms, lawns, and sewage systems. The acidification results when CO2 enters the ocean's waters and changes the chemical balance. CO2 neutralizes the calcium carbonate in the water. Oyster, crab, lobster, clam, and mussel larvae depend on the calcium carbonate to form their shells. With the increased acidification, the larvae are dying in large numbers. Fisheries along the Washington and Oregon coasts produce over $100 million in annual sales. As this industry is being negatively impacted, jobs and local income will be directly affected. Coastal areas such as Puget Sound are being polluted with chemical runoff from the Columbia River and other areas, contributing to increased acidification and algae bloom.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for the Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio, featuring Linda Merrick, the executive director of 9 to 5. She'll speak about yesterday's statement about inequality made at the Oscars and why women need equal pay to their male counterparts. This will be followed by Labor Radio at 6. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline, featuring a talk by Maya Shinwar. She'll speak about her book, Locked Down, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better. Maya's book looks at how prison breaks community ties and enacts violence, which continues after release, making communities less safe and, in particular, decimating communities of color. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is similar to today, a little bit cooler with a high of 59, but sunny with a 0% chance of rain. Today in history, on February 23, 1954, the first polio vaccines were given to a group of children from Arsenal Elementary School in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Within 20 years, the disease was entirely eradicated from the United States. The quote of the day is from author Mark Twain, who said, "I have never let my schooling interfere with my education."
It's 5:26. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Good news, people. The boom is back. Good times are here again, thanks to an economic boom generated by, of all things, bad times. Tens of millions of Americans have been knocked down and held down in recent years by the collapse of jobs and wages. This calamity has led to a second blow for millions of the same families, who now find themselves buried in overdue bills for credit card charges, student loans, and other consumer debt. But there's a bright silver lining in that dark financial cloud. Only, it's not for the indebted families, but for a booming breed of finance hucksters known as consumer debt buyers. Believe it or not, in the warped world of high finance, there's gold in them thar hills of bad debt. Such miners of human misery as Encore Capital Group buy bales of unpaid bills from banks and other lenders, paying pennies on the dollar. Then, they unleash packs of their hard-nosed, aggressive collectors on the families. If they still can't extract payment, the debt profiteers turn to their meanest dog, the courts. Debt firms routinely file thousands of lawsuits a day against financially devastated Americans. They know that most debtors can't understand the legal gibberish in the suits, can't afford a lawyer, and can't mount an effective defense against the corporate lawyers. So, some 95% of these lawsuits produce default judgments against hapless borrowers, meaning debt buyers can then confiscate the wages of borrowers or freeze their bank accounts. This is Jim Hightower saying, this boom in vulture capitalism is disgusting. But worse, it's subsidized by us taxpayers. We pay for that judicial system, the judges, courtrooms, and endless rounds of hearings. Predatory debt corporations have perverted our so-called justice system into their own subsidiary for squeezing profits out of destitute debtors.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
And now, We hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Is labor in solidarity around fighting right to work? The answer is a resounding yes.
Wisconsin AFL-CIO President Phil Neuenfeld. Wisconsin workers are mobilizing against the anti-union right to work bill being fast-tracked through the state legislature this week by Republicans. Rallies are set for Tuesday and Wednesday as the state Senate takes up the bill in an extraordinary session of the state legislature, a move designed to limit debate and speed passage of the anti-union bill. Neuenfeld says this bill will hurt all workers, not just union members.
Right to work is an attack on all Wisconsin families. Right to work cripples the fundamental rights of all workers to join together, stick together, and have each other's back in the workplace. When solidarity is eroded, it's the entire middle class who suffers. Collective bargaining and unions help set the standards in terms of wages and working conditions for all workers in a community. And unions provide essential training and knowledge with apprenticeship for workers.
UFCW 1473's John Iden appealed to Republican senators to vote their conscience on this bill.
Make no mistake, this bill is going to affect not only union members, but non-union members. Everyone's wages are going to be reduced as a result of this. And I encourage the Republican senators to have courage to vote against this and not rubber stamp it.
By attacking union automatic dues paycheck deductions, backers of the bill are trying to defund and thus weaken unions. Betsy Kippers is president of the Wisconsin Education Association Council, which lost collective bargaining rights in the 2011 Act 10 legislation.
This will not bring in new workers and more people to work. We already are seeing in educators, people are leaving the state because they're not respected and their value is not being reflected in being able to have a voice in what's important to give us a strong education system. And this will take away the voice of what's important to make sure we have good paying jobs, good safety regulations, and good training for all of the high quality workers in Wisconsin.
A new National Employment Law Project report says paying home care workers $15 an hour would not only put $16.5 billion in their pockets, but would add tens of thousands of new jobs to the U.S. economy. Home care workers pushing for $15 in a union are organizing town halls across the country to help energize their campaign. The NELP report says that $6.6 billion in economic activity would be added to our economy if home care workers were paid $15 an hour.
Workers Independent News is brought to you by the American Federation of Teachers and its 1.6 million members working to reclaim the promise of public education, health care, and public services for our students, their families, and our communities. More information online at aft.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Today, 15 former students of the for-profit college chain Corinthian Colleges Incorporated launched the nation's first debtor strike. With this strike, the debt forgiveness movement born out of Occupy Wall Street entered a new stage in its activism around student loans. The former students have said that they will not repay any more of their student loans in protest of what they describe as predatory lending practices on the part of Corinthian Colleges and the U.S. Department of Education. Organizers working with Debt Collective said the coordinated action was a test run for larger debt refusal actions. For their test case, Debt Collective settled a particularly ripe target. Corinthian College has been the subject of state and federal investigations regarding its lending practices. Since June 2014, the company has been under tight financial supervision from the Department of Education, which is shepherding it through the process of selling off some of its campuses and shutting down others. Here's a clip from the statement released by the students through the Debt Collective.
Corinthian Colleges include Everest, Heald, and Wyotech. These schools offer low-wage workers, single mothers, first-generation college students, and people of color an open door to a substandard education at a cost so high that payback would last a lifetime.
The Corinthian 15 are a group of former students of Corinthian's Everest College, and they have declared that they cannot and will not repay their loans.
To the Department of Education, who are we? We are the first generation made poor by the business of education. We are the people living paycheck to paycheck, single mothers and young people just starting out. We wanted an education because we were driven to learn and to achieve a better life for ourselves and for our families.
We trusted that education would lead to a better life, and we trusted you to ensure that education system in this country would do so. But Corinthian took advantage of our dreams and targeted us to make a profit. You let that happen, and now you cash in.
Each month you force us to make payments into an immoral system that profits from our aspirations. We pay dearly for degrees that have led to unemployment or to jobs that don't pay a living wage. We can't and won't pay any longer. Repayment plans presented as a helping hand simply aren't good enough. The wrong done to us is deeper than that.
We are not alone in this fight. Corinthian's predatory empire pushed hundreds of thousands into a debt trap. But even beyond for-profit schools, tens of millions of students are more in debt than they can ever repay. And you are the debt collector, with powers beyond a payday lender's wildest dreams.
To the Department of Education and to the lenders, servers, and guarantee agencies who have stolen our futures, we say enough. Erase these loans. To current and former college students across the country, we say we stand with you to demand the end of higher education systems that profits from all of our dreams. Join our fight. We won't pay.
This strike is on behalf of all people who are drowning in debt for the basic necessities in life, like housing, healthcare, and education.
Join them as they demand that the Department of Education cancel their debts.
This public declaration of a strike by the Corinthian 15 marks the beginning of a new era of debtor solidarity and collective disobedience in the face of creditors' immoral behavior and impossible demands.
If you attended a Corinthian school or you'd like to learn more, please go to debtcollective.org.
Alaska is the third state in the United States that now has legal marijuana available. As of Tuesday, adult Alaskans can not only keep and use pot, they can transport, grow it, and give it away. While recreational marijuana is legal, smoking in public can result in a $100 fine. A second phase, creating a regulated and taxed marijuana market, won't start until 2016 at the earliest. Recreational marijuana will be legal in Oregon on July 1, 2015.
The Center for Constitutional Rights has called on a federal court to dismiss a terrorism indictment against two animal rights activists. The activists are accused of freeing thousands of animals from Midwestern fur farms. The activists were indicted under the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. But their attorneys claim that the act is unconstitutional and should be struck down. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with one of the attorneys on the case, Michael Deutsch, with the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I wonder if you could start by telling us a little bit about the case against the two activists who are facing terrorism charges for freeing mink in an Illinois facility.
Yeah, there's two young men who are charged with violating the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. It's a relatively new statute passed in 1996 that makes it a crime to interfere with an animal enterprise, which is a very broad language. It doesn't specify any specific act that is considered interference, but anything that disrupts or in any way interferes with an animal enterprise is a violation of this law, which has been designated as the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. And the animal enterprise is also not defined in such a way that the government, in the argument when we moved to dismiss the statute as unconstitutional, basically said if you threw a rock through a Whole Foods grocery, that could be considered animal enterprise terrorism because Whole Foods has animal products and they sell animal products. And you could be charged with a federal crime and basically look at up to 10 or 20 years in prison.
And what's the relation to the case that was dismissed by a court of appeals last year that the CCR had filed, Blum versus Holder, which also challenged the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act as far as being unconstitutional?
Well, in that case, the court dismissed it because it said that the plaintiffs, it was a civil case, not a criminal defense case, and it said the plaintiffs did not have standing. They were saying that this statute chills people who want to carry out First Amendment Protected Act protesting abuse or violation of the rights of animals. And the court in that case said that those people could not show that they were going to be a likely target of the statute. It was too premature. It was too speculative. So they basically dismissed the plaintiff's case. Now we're in a situation where actually people are being charged with violating that statute. So they clearly have standing to challenge the constitutionality of the statute.
Now, freeing minks, releasing them from captivity, is not something that I think most people would associate with terrorism, which normally involves violence. You mentioned the 1996 Act, the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, but how is it that that's been able to stay on the books as defining the freeing of animals as terrorism?
Well, there hasn't been a specific challenge that has withstood that challenge to that statute because of standing, or in one case there was a case in California which ultimately was dismissed before it got to the point of challenging the statute. One of the arguments the government made is that terrorism is not going to be mentioned in the trial. It's not really an element of the statute or the crime. It's just the title of the crime. But, of course, what we argued is that once you're convicted under that statute, it's easy for the government to refer to it and the defendants as convicted terrorists. So there's all kinds of things, consequences that can flow from being convicted under the statute.
Well, we will continue to follow this issue here at KABU. Again, we've been speaking with Michael Deutsch with the Center for Constitutional Rights, which has filed a legal challenge to the charge of animal enterprise terrorism against two Illinois activists who were earlier convicted of possession of burglary tools for the freeing of a number of minks from an animal facility. This is Jenka Soderberg with KABU News.
2 weeks ago, three young American Muslims were executed in their Chapel Hill home by an Islamophobic white neighbor. This incident is just the most brutal of a string of attacks against Muslims in the U.S. over the last several weeks. Human rights groups have linked the recent upsurge in attacks to both the Charlie Hebdo shootings in France last month and the release of the American Sniper film, which promotes stereotypes of Arabs and Muslims and led to a storm of racist and anti-Muslim slurs on Twitter. An arson attack last week against the Kuba Islamic Institute in Houston, Texas, left one of its buildings completely destroyed. Other crimes included the harassment of a Muslim family in a Dearborn, Michigan Kroger store, the slashing of Muslim families' car tires in El Paso, Texas, the posting of threatening notes around Revere, Massachusetts, and harassing phone calls made to a number of mosques around Ohio. In many cases, such as the fire at the Islamic Center in Houston, police authorities and media have attempted to spin the crime as unrelated to the victim's faith. Just as the Chapel Hill shootings were immediately connected to a purported parking dispute, police in Houston claimed that arsonist Daryl Ferguson was, quote, just trying to stay warm. But the explicit hate involved in most of the attacks makes it clear that the attackers are targeting Muslims for their faith. At the Islamic School of Rhode Island, the perpetrators spray-painted direct insults to the Muslim faith. In Bothell, Washington, Muslims Go Home was spray-painted on a Muslim school. The perpetrators also targeted a nearby Hindu temple where they drew swastikas and wrote, Go home. In an article published Friday, the president of the Arizona chapter of the Council of American Islamic Relations, Imran Siddiqui, warned Muslim communities in the United States to be extra vigilant for their safety. Siddiqui said that as long as U.S. officials and media are participating in the rhetoric of Islamophobia and failing to acknowledge its implications, Americans will continually be affected by the spate of violence directed not just towards Muslims, but also towards others perceived to be Muslims, such as Hindus, Arab Christians, and those of African descent. The president of the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee said the group continues to be contacted by Arab and Muslim Americans who are afraid to report hate crimes to law enforcement because of fear that their rights will be violated. The committee said that the government must behave in a way so that victims of hate crimes and violent extremism know that government agencies are there to protect their rights and safety, not just monitor their religious and political expression.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, February 23rd, 2015. Israeli troops invade West Bank communities and injure civilians. In the meantime, Israel's electricity company cuts off power to major Palestinian cities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Four Palestinian civilians were injured on Sunday late at night by live rounds fired by Israeli troops after dozens of soldiers invaded the Aida refugee camp in the southern West Bank city of Bethlehem. The wounded Palestinians suffered moderate injuries and were moved to Beit Jala governmental hospital in the city. Scores of Palestinians suffered the effects of tear gas inhalation, especially after the soldiers fired gas bombs at several homes. The soldiers also invaded several homes and violently searched them, causing property damage and interrogated the families. In addition, a number of soldiers occupied rooftops of some homes and used them as military towers. On Monday at dawn, Israeli soldiers invaded various areas in the occupied West Bank, stormed and searched several homes before kidnapping five Palestinians and handed one resident a military order for interrogation. Kidnappings and home searches were reported in the southern West Bank cities of Hebron and Bethlehem, the central West Bank city of Ramallah, and Jenin in northern West Bank. Elsewhere, dozens of Israeli soldiers invaded on Monday morning the Jerusalem Gate protest village